Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by conservative commentator Marty Garrity, liberal columnist Salim Muwakkil, and Democratic political strategist Kitty Kirth. Our program tonight, coming from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on Chicago's fashionable Near North Side, where our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, the email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. And happy Easter to you all. Nice to have you with us. Tonight we're going to be talking about foreign policy and the problems in Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq in hour number one. And in hour number two, we'll continue our discussion about presidential politics for 2012 and some of the ongoing public battles that have already broken out between Donald Trump and some former national Republican operatives, namely Karl Rove. We started that conversation last week, inundated with calls for a couple of hours. We're going to talk a little bit more about that and the broader issues that will define and separate Republicans from Democrats as we head to the polls in November of 2012. But first, as you may have heard or read, John McCain, the senator from Arizona, spent some time recently, last few days. He was in Libya. He has come back with a report that he fears for a stalemate in Libya. He said that the rebel fighters were badly outgunned in armor, in equipment, in training against the forces of Muammar Gaddafi. He went on to say that it is very possible, in his view, that al-Qaeda could come in and take advantage of the potential stalemate. This comes at a time when South Carolina senator and close friend of Senator McCain's, Lindsey Graham, has said that I think the focus now should be to cut the head of the snake off. That means get Gaddafi. We begin this evening by asking our two left-of-center guests, and we've got a couple of them with us this evening. I want to start with you, Salim Muwakkil, senior editor of In These Times.
Yes.
You have generally presented an anti-war position on this program in the
generally
20 years you've been on the show. You supported Barack Obama.
I certainly did.
How happy or displeased are you that Barack Obama has demonstrated a hawk-like attitude, at least insofar as Libya is concerned?
I'm very disappointed in the president. And it's doubly ironic that the first African-American president should be one who vigorously advocates bombing Africa. It's almost poetically ironic that we would have this situation. It's too bad that he was persuaded to take this kind of action. Some people say it was humanitarian intervention, but it doesn't look that way to me.
Joining us also is a Democratic political strategist, a longtime favorite of this program, Kitty Kirth. Kitty, again, your political career, you're generally on the left side. You're generally in support of anti-war candidates. You helped elect Barack Obama. Your reaction to the same question?
I'm torn and glad that I don't have his job this week, and I'll tell you why. We also spend a lot of our time working with the Hotel Rwanda Recessa Begina Foundation. We're advocating for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission for Rwanda. Rwanda is a place where I think the U.S. needed to go in and didn't to stop that genocide. I look at it with a heavy heart, and, you know, it's not an easy situation in Libya. I don't advocate that the U.S. jump in everywhere, especially not, as you say, in Africa. It's kind of ironic. On the other hand, I don't want us to have the blood on our hands that we do from Rwanda. You know, if we had intervened a little earlier or made the U.N. work a little stronger, 800,000 people would be alive. We don't want another genocide. We don't want another, you know, sectarian.
Our card-carrying conservative tonight is Marty Garrity. Marty, you have heard our two Democrats basically say that they're not wild about what's happening and what Barack Obama's doing. As a conservative Republican coming from a sector of the American electorate that generally supports military intervention, what's yours? I see you grimacing as I said that. That means that you separate yourself from Republican ideology for the most part. But what's your reaction to their reaction?
Well, I guess I agree with them in terms of being very uneasy with what has gone on in Libya. When you think about the fundamental day of the action reason that Obama gave, that is to say, if we don't intervene right now, Benghazi will become a bloodbath. There is simply no evidence that that was about to happen. There is no evidence that that sort of thing happened in any other place where Muammar Gaddafi's forces succeeded. Obama invented that notion of a bloodbath in Benghazi out of whole cloth.
Benghazi is a bloodbath. If you listen to BBC Radio every day this week,
right.
They've been talking about people being killed, still being killed. It is a bloodbath.
Because of the battles going on there.
But it has been for 3 weeks.
But it was not. The argument was that if Gaddafi took charge, if he was in charge in Benghazi, he would go through the city slaughtering people left and right, as happened in Rwanda. What's going on in Benghazi right now is an ongoing sort of low-grade battle that involves people getting killed and some collateral damage, but nothing like the 800,000 dead that Obama said was going to happen if he didn't send in the Air Force.
So do you support the president? Are you opposed to this? I mean, what's your position?
Actually, my position is very close to Kitty Kurth's in terms of what happened in Rwanda and in looking at places where bad bloodbaths, slaughters, genocide might occur. And if you look at the Middle East, you'd have to say that Iran is a place where that could happen. Why aren't we intervening in Iran?
Syria.
It's already happening in Syria.
Yemen.
A little bit. Yemen. Yeah, that's right. Well, it's not exactly a that's just fighting, though, in Yemen. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any killing of unarmed civilians. Mm-hmm. But the one place where it's really happening and we're doing nothing is the Sudan.
Oh.
Darfur, but also a couple of other places in Sudan where they are either near the border with the south of Sudan,
which will soon be another nation. The army of the Lord, or whatever, is coming across. So when
should we back to Salim now?
Mm-hmm.
Salim, again, as a liberal, mm-hmm. when should we use the might of the United States to engage ourselves around the world for the first purpose of saving lives for humanitarian purposes? That's one question. Mm-hmm. And the second question is, when it appears that that's getting out of hand, when do we move to the next step? I want you to think about both of those answers as well as everybody else. We do have to pause. The question has been asked. I want to get your reaction as well. Your reaction to what's happening in Libya. Should we be doing more, as Senator McCain is now suggesting? He's threatening that if we don't do more, Al-Qaeda can come in and fill the vacuum. Do you believe that, or is that just a scare tactic of a conservative Republican militarist? Back shortly from Chicago. From Austin, Texas, to East Liverpool, Ohio, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Salim Uwakil is with us. We're going to take calls in just a moment, but before the break, I asked the question, and this is a question that I'd like to really get a response really from everybody. I mean, at what point does the power and influence and the might of the United States, when should we use that power to help a country that is being victimized by its leader and brutalized and being victims of slaughter? Mm. When do we do that? When do we stand up and say, enough is enough, we're going to send in the Marines or whoever to stop it?
Well, I think we should be very reluctant to do it at any time. I think we should take this opportunity to kind of change our approach to foreign policy and lose the gunboat diplomacy, start to bring some of our troops home from these imperial places that they are stationed and use the UN more effectively. It's just as we're urging and goading NATO to take more action.
Do you think we are using the UN wisely right now?
I don't think so at all.
Well, what more could we be doing?
We could be more insistent. We could add some military heft to the UN's mission.
And one of the things with the UN, you know, they're trying to get the Organization of African States has said, look, this is our problem. This is our part of the world. We need to be more involved in the solution. And I think maybe that's...
You mean the African Union?
Both. Oh, okay. OAS and the African Union.
Kitty, what is your answer to the same question?
This is why I'm really glad I'm president of Kirth Lampe and not president of the United States. I mean, these are the grand questions of our time. You know, I would hope that I'd be listening, if I were President Obama, I'd be listening to Secretary Clinton. I would be listening to the generals. I would try to get as much information because I don't think that we're getting all of it through the media.
But philosophically, if you were you're a political liberal, if you're a political liberal, one of the tenets of liberalism, as I perceive it, is you see people who are in trouble or there's an injustice. You folks want to jump in and change it. You want to
help them.
You want
Absolutely.
To throw them a lifesaver. So
Absolutely.
My question is then for those that say maybe we have to throw more lifesavers, not fewer lifesavers, why do you not stand up and say, you know what, that really is, that's the logical progression of a liberal political philosophy. More involvement, not less.
Because it's also about getting into war, which is also something that I'm against. So, you know, if we could just go in and help them at a humanitarian level, that would be great. But obviously that's not a possibility.
But in the real world, don't you have to deal with the deck that has, you know, the cards that have been filled? If you have someone who is murdering and slaughtering people, sometimes you just can't go in under the UN
right.
flag and say, folks, hey, do me a favor. Don't stop this.
And
you got to use your might.
And peacekeepers are not peacemakers. And maybe we should change that whole mission of the UN. But at the same time, that's why I think we need to talk to the people in the neighborhood. We need to talk to the other countries around Libya. We need to really get those folks engaged in the solution.
The African Union offered a way out for the mm-hmm. world, actually. And Gaddafi had agreed to it. And they basically had convinced him to eventually relinquish power, but to, you know, an exit with honor for Gaddafi. And yet people turned it down, especially the opposition, because they wanted, their condition was for Gaddafi to leave immediately.
Marty, yeah. your answer to the same question from a conservative perspective.
My answer to the same question is that the United States has to care about the United States. That if American interests are at risk, if American soldiers or citizens are at risk, we need to intervene. I'm not even sure that I would have agreed to an American intervention in as grievous an instance as Rwanda, but certainly not the minimal stuff that's going on in Libya or was supposedly going to be going on in Libya. And I don't think we should intervene with good feelings at the base of it, but I especially don't think that we ought to take 10,000 American troops and put them under a French or a British or an Italian general. If we're going to send in troops, I don't want them going in as the UN. I want them going in as the American military, where the American military will decide how these men and women are going to be deployed in order to advance American interests. That's what I pay taxes for. I don't pay taxes to protect people in Rwanda or Libya or...
Don't you have that in Iraq? For the most part, don't you have that in Iraq? Where it's primarily a U.S., is purely a U.S.
Yes.
mission.
It's a U.S. mission.
Happy with the way
and
that's
Afghanistan.
Turning out?
Afghanistan,
too.
Okay.
I am happy with Iraq. We have the makings of a successful intervention there. We went in there to get rid of a guy who was perceived by everybody in the world as a threat to the United States. We got rid of him.
Oh, no.
Well, you know,
not everybody in the world.
Every intelligence agency in the world knew that he had weapons of mass destruction. Everybody agreed.
Excuse
There's
me?
No argument about
We've
that.
All
We now know that they were all wrong.
We all know that Hans Blix told us there were no weapons of mass destruction.
Hans Blix was a fellow who never found weapons of mass destruction anywhere. All of the intelligence, right. French, British,
we're not going to fight the Iraq war here. Just not true. We can argue about opinions, but we can't argue about the facts.
Right.
We can't argue about the facts. There was no one legitimately who really believed, other than George Bush and his cronies, that there were weapons of mass destruction.
Kitty. What about all the Democratic members of the United States Senate, including Hillary Rodham Clinton and many others, who believed the intelligence agencies, not only the United States, but our allies, they all agreed.
I don't think that's right.
The allies are saying now that all of them, let's deal with facts and let's deal with history.
I don't believe that that's right.
You think it was just George Bush? You don't remember?
And perhaps that's Tony Blair. But were it not for Blair and Bush,
none of the other intelligence agencies would have gone along with it. They were relying on our intelligence.
The French were stronger in favor of invading, of saying he had a WMD, than the American or the British intelligence agency. That's the fact.
Okay, now, speaking of facts, let's go to Austin, Texas, so we don't get bogged down in the quagmire of debating the Iraq war. Let's go to Austin, Texas, where Joe was listening to us. There was such uniformity
for the first time on your panel, Bruce.
Yes.
And all of a sudden this red herring comes up about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction.
Well, anyhow, they had to realize that they had to fight about something. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Well, no. Please, committee. I've been loving you. I'm a conservative and a Republican, and I just love what I hear from your panel, all three members. But I just wanted to take this occasion to thoroughly denounce Senator John McCain. He is proving to be a real nut who just plays to the media. Mm. Of course, the media loves him and treats him like an expert. What is he, the honorary Secretary of State? The Republicans didn't even appoint him to go over there and open his mouth. I mean, he is an embarrassment. He would have been a worse president, I'm convinced, than Obama. I mean, I'm glad we elected Obama instead of that clown of McCain.
All right. Am I a conservative? I'm agreeing with everything this guy is saying.
Well, okay. Yeah, everybody's in
it. It must be something in the water in Austin.
But let me, do you put Senator Graham in the same category?
Yes. I mean, Senator Lindsey Graham, he's bloodthirsty. He's even, I would say McCain thinks is an egomaniac, but Lindsey Graham is a bloodthirsty idiot. He wants to cut off Gaddafi? What gives him the right? I mean, what are we? What kind of a lynch mob are we?
Must be the Ron Paul influence now in Texas.
Marty, your reaction to this conservative Republican from Texas?
Well, I agree with everything he said about, except that McCain would have been a worse president than Obama. I can't imagine that phenomenon of somebody being a worse president.
But you're not a fan of McCain's.
But I'm not a fan of McCain's. Absolutely not, especially not now. Because he's now saying, we should help these guys, but everything we do may end up in the hands of Al-Qaeda. Well, I'm sorry, that is a really bad outcome. The one thing
he also reported, I mean, in the earlier reports, it wasn't on Meet the Press today. I mean, he said basically, based on his conversations with the rebel leaders, it was his opinion that they were not connected to Al-Qaeda, which has been an issue on this program and people have been debating for the last couple of months, whether or not if we gave the rebels more weapons, would those weapons be ultimately used against us, as was the case in Afghanistan?
You cannot find out whether these guys are Al-Qaeda by sitting down and talking to them. You've got to talk to the deep cover intelligence people, and they are at best not sure about what's going on. And if for McCain to come in and say, well, I've talked to them, it kind of reminds me of George W. Bush saying, I looked Putin in the eye and he was a good guy or something like that, whatever he said.
Also,
you can't just talk to these guys and
find
out.
But also in a situation like this where on CNN today, Lindsey Graham said, I think the focus now should be to cut the head of the snake off, which means basically get rid of, take Gaddafi out. Mm. Haven't we been trying to do that for about 10 years? I mean, do we have to publicly announce that we want to off this guy?
Actually,
first of all, it's against U.S. policy.
I was going to say, isn't that against our laws?
Yeah.
But going back a minute, too, I think there's two separate questions. Will the weapons fall into the wrong hands, and will the weapons fall into the hands of al-Qaeda? You know, those are two really different issues. And
yes,
just because we have enemies overseas doesn't mean they're al-Qaeda.
But some of Gaddafi's most ardent opponents are Islamists. They've always hated him because they say he corrupted the Quran.
He's too secular.
Yes.
He's too secular.
Right. But if they are true Islamists and truly Muslim, that means they're really not, don't want to have anything to do with al-Qaeda.
It's not necessarily al-Qaeda, but Islamists.
Islamists don't want to have to do with al-Qaeda?
Nothing to do with al-Qaeda.
Anyway, we have to pause. 1-800-723-8229. Thanks for Austin, Texas, for reporting in. We got a lot of other places coming to you in a moment after we pause for some commercials. Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us tonight on Easter Sunday, 2011. Joining us this evening, we have Salim Uwakil. He is the senior editor of In These Times, one of the country's leading progressive periodicals. He's also a talk show host on WVON Radio in Chicago. Marty Garrity also joins us. He's our card-carrying conservative Republican. He is a commercial real estate executive when he's not pontificating on the radio. And joining us right now, looking into the camera and smiling for those watching us on TV, is Kitty Kurth. She is a Democratic political strategist. She's the president of Kurth Lampe. That is a noted media and political consulting firm, and doing a lot of work on Facebook and tweeting as we speak to people all over the world.
I was just sending a message.
See if anybody is listening to us in Tripoli tonight to call in. 1-800-723-8029, in case you just tuned in. We're talking about U.S. policy specifically in Libya. And one of the questions I want to just ask rhetorically, and then we're going to take a couple of calls. Because of the strong military position that many liberals believe that the president is taking. Now, conservatives don't think he's strong enough. But again, the political anti-war left who helped elect Barack Obama, as Salim has said, many are disappointed, or he said certainly he is disappointed. So my question, if you consider yourself in that sector of the American voters, what is your reaction? And is there any chance at all that someone would challenge the president for renomination in 2012? Or do you sit on your hands? What impact would your lack of enthusiasm for Barack Obama, how would that be signaled in 2012? Think of the answer. Call in with the answer. But right now, let's head to Michael in Knoxville, Tennessee, listening to us on WNOX. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call there, Bruce. I think sometimes when I listen to some of your panel, I think I'm in a twilight zone. Admiral Mike Mullen was before the House and the Senate answering questions about this issue even before we went into Libya with the Air Force. And I believe what he had said was that at this point, all evidence shows that this was a general uprising. It happened on the same day that Gaddafi's son was in the United States looking at purchasing some equipment that is for anti-terrorist combat. And that's when the protest broke out. The other issue which he made mention of is that Libya at this point was the strongest regime militarily that could, if things went worse for the Libyan regime, could end up posing a threat to our Africa command, which a lot of people apparently seem to forget that we have one. Given the fact that Libya was extremely tenuous because of the general uprising, at that point he stated that there was relatively very few people affiliated or even sympathized with al-Qaeda, maybe in the number of 400 to 500 people total. The stalemate, or if the regime had survived, would have done no more than increase the numbers hostile to our interests, as well as the Gaddafi regime, which was our partner in the war against terrorism.
All right, let's take a breath right now. Let's let everybody respond to what you said. We'll start with Salim.
I'm not quite sure where the call is coming from. I did hear him talk about the AFRICOM, and I think that that's one of the issues that a lot of people have problems with, that America is militarizing its presence in Africa, much more so with AFRICOM, and using AFRICOM to coordinate some of the attacks on Libya, and that's very disturbing.
I think one of the points that he was trying to make is that with U.S. and with NATO involvement in Libya now, does it increase the likelihood of Al-Qaeda recruiting
there? Yes, I do.
There,
I think so.
Which is what John McCain said. That was one of the fears he had.
I think the presence of the West in this incursion, I think, is increasing the allure of these kinds of responses.
Even though Gaddafi was against Al-Qaeda.
He's very much
against
it.
And they hated each other. So, again, if there's a force that's going in there to get rid of someone that hates you, why would that become a recruitment opportunity?
It's kind of triangulated, isn't it?
Does that make any common sense? Hang on, Michael, we'll come back to you, but I want to get Kitty and Marty's response.
No, but I was also interested in something else that Michael said, that he said that Gaddafi's son was here buying weapons. Is what I think he said.
Anti-terrorist weapons.
And that Libya was a partner with the U.S. in its anti-terrorism efforts.
Yeah, and that seems a little bit silly if we're selling weapons to somebody who at the same time we're looking to take out of power.
Michael's
notion that we were somehow partners with Libya is news to me, and I pay some attention to this thing. Quite frankly, though, if you had to ask me, start listing the people in that area that you'd like to see taken out. One of the last ones I'd like to see taken out is the regime that about 8 or 9 years ago said, okay, you can come in here and take all of our nuclear weapons out. We'll give up our entire nuclear program.
We will cooperate with you on anti-terrorism.
That's right. Bashar Assad hasn't said that. In fact, the only reason he doesn't have a nuclear program in Syria right now is the Israelis bombed it to smithereens. For that matter, North Korea.
So what is your answer to that? Because the answer to the question is the regime that did that was Muammar Gaddafi.
Right.
So there were some people, which, by the way, it makes sense that maybe his son was indeed here, because at one point we thought that he was a bad guy, but he was our bad guy.
Well, I mean, he's a bad guy. He knocked down our airplane over Scotland.
I know, but again, in a diplomatic way, we sort of kissed and made up when he gave up his weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
We forgot that he shot down the plane in Lockerbie, okay?
Right.
So we looked the other way.
He shot it down. A bomb exploded They concluded that it was a Libyan agent. There's a lot of dispute about that as well.
What I'm saying is this guy went from a pariah of the world.
Right.
All right, 9/11 comes, suddenly he becomes less of a pariah.
Correct.
And basically he's sort of out of the news for months or a year or several years, and then all of a sudden, not only does this one-time pariah come back, now all of a sudden we're sending within a few days, we're sending drones in and we're waging war against the guy.
If you've got drones, that many drones to send in, I say send them to Iran, send them to Syria. I'm not saying that we should do this, but if you're gonna send in drones somewhere, frankly, Libya is one of my last places I want to send in drones.
Okay, but the answer to the question, why did they do it there then? You don't want to send. Michael, what's your answer to the question?
The answer for the question is plainly seen as it's clear as day. You have a general uprising. The population in Libya were disgusted with Gaddafi as much as the Egyptians were disgusted with Muammar.
Right.
Oh, no. You know what?
I'll finish.
If I may, sir, please.
Go on.
Okay. Once they seen that there was a reapproachment between the West, Europe, and the United States with Gaddafi, and they were even contemplating accepting one of his sons as his successor, that's when the situation boiled over in Libya. Once the situation boiled over in Libya, we had one of two choices. We can either accept the status quo and have all these people from the East, from the West, and from the South join up with the insurgency against him, which he had labeled as Islamist, which really wasn't, but he had labeled them as Islamist. We can then have all these people who are the general population who is against the Libya regime join up with the insurgents there and risk alienating ourselves from that region, having a country or a regime which is now the most militaristic or militarized in, with equipment, as we have now seen, in the region, posing a threat to our Africa command, or we could help them. That is the way it is. Right. Thank you, sir.
All right, we're going to move on. Listen, thanks very much for calling. I think you got your money's worth. Let's go to George in Schaumburg on WLS, our flagship station. Go ahead.
Okay, Bruce. Good evening to all of you guys on the panel. Listen, here's another take on this thing. First off, I think McCain and Lindsey Graham are delusional, as most of the people in Washington are. You know, we've got a $14-plus trillion debt, and we're off trying to start another war. This is ludicrous, okay? I came across an article a couple of days ago, which I found to be rather interesting. Don't know how true it is, but the article was written by a woman by the name of Ellen Brown, who apparently is tied into some kind of international banking type work or something like that. I think it's publicbankinginstitute.org is where she's from. Bottom line is, which the argument was made, we're there not for oil and we're not there for human rights. We're there because the IMF and basically the one world government types want to get their gold, which is substantial. I guess they got $140 billion worth of gold sitting over there, coupled with the fact that they just established their own central bank. Now, I don't know if you guys remember this, but they started a central bank a few weeks ago when the rebels were starting to take over. Now, who are these rebels? What did your panel think about this?
All right. Stay on the line. We're going to let them respond. We're going to a commercial break. I want to get their reaction to your question and then give you the last word. 1-800-723-8289. Back shortly from Chicago, from coast to coast and border to border on Easter Sunday 2011. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Marty Gehr, do you want to tackle our caller's question? He's standing on the line.
He was talking about the... I'm sorry. I'm thinking of the last... what was the question?
Summarize your question. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, my question was, based on what was going on in Libya, it's not about human rights or even oil for the United States. I mean, it might be oil for Europe, but Libya's got their own central bank, and they've got 140-some tons of... gold over there, and this article by Ellen Brown was very informative, where basically what she was saying was the IMF and basically the one world government community on planet Earth is trying to get into Libya and to basically take Gaddafi down because he won't play nice with the people that want to bring him into the fold, and that's what this whole thing is about, and it kind of makes sense because he is against Al-Qaeda, and even though he did nasty things to people, to us, a long time ago, you know, we're using him to our benefit right now. So why do we want to destabilize Libya? Haven't we done enough damage in Egypt and elsewhere?
Well, that's really my question. Why would we pick on a relatively small potatoes place like Libya with a population of, I don't know, 6 or 7 million people and $120 million worth of gold that's you know, Obama borrows that on a daily basis. So I'm not sure why that's such an important thing.
Let's Salim's got a comment.
Yeah, I think the IMF and those other MFs, as I like to say.
yeah, I agree with that.
I am so stealing that line.
they were covetously looking at Libya. And Libya, you know, what Gaddafi had threatened was more nationalization of the oil. He had consolidated the African Union and was investing heavily in African countries and attempting to convince them to restrict AFRICOM's entrance into those countries. And so there was some hostility on that end. And I think that the caller has a very good point, because the IMF and all of those international banking institutions were very, very nervous about Gaddafi's intentions.
What can you tell us about the relationship between Muammar Gaddafi and the American African-American community, specifically Minister Farrakhan? Because there had been olive branch relationships built, bonds built between.
Absolutely.
So tell us about the depth, the breadth, and the influence that Gaddafi has in some sectors of the American black community.
Well, Gaddafi lent Elijah Muhammad the money to buy the mosque on Stony Island in 74th. That's the first instance, and then he lent additional millions to Louis Farrakhan when the Nation of Islam was attempting to develop a personal toiletry industry. And so there is a strong relationship between Colonel Gaddafi and Louis Farrakhan, and also other, I guess you would call nationalist, black nationalist organizations in this country, because of Gaddafi's outreach, his readiness to recognize these organizations. He was a very strong supporter of the Black Panther Party, for example, and so Gaddafi and the Nation of Islam and recently. Obama sent one of his surrogates, a guy named Michael Blake, to Chicago to try to firm up the support in the black community for the president. And they had a town hall meeting in which he was attempting to reach out to the black community and inform them what the president was doing in their behalf. And it turned out. It turned into a very raucous affair because many of the people in the audience wanted some response to Libya. They wanted him to make some sort of response to why the president.
So within the black community, black communities that you are aware of, there is strong pro-Gaddafi sentiments.
I wouldn't go that far.
I think that's a leap.
There's some pro-Gaddafi sentiment.
There's always been a lot of outreach on Gaddafi's part to African-American leaders, but I don't think in the broader African-American community people know or care about
the former
Gaddafi.
State senator who represented much of these communities is now the president of the United States.
That's right.
So he wasn't
really in those circles. He doesn't really run in the circles that.
That's true.
That Gaddafi
he was not aware of it. Though?
Well, he's aware of it. He's aware of it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. And he's been aware of it for a long time.
He's never run with the black nationalists. No. You know, they're also of a different generation than he is. Most of the people with whom Gaddafi has relationships are much older than the president.
Let's go to Joseph in Crown Point, Indiana, the town that John Dillinger put on the map. Go ahead.
Good evening. Love your show.
Thank you.
The point I want to make is that I'm all about, and America's been all about freedom. If these freedom fighters are truly democracy-seeking people and they're trying to throw off the chains of tyranny, then America should back them 100%. But what I'm concerned about, and what I think everybody seems to want to brush over in the mainstream media, is we may have just instilled a jihadist regime in Libya, because there are reports that come in, and I know the blogosphere is not as accurate as it could be, that there are members of Al-Qaeda, there are former Taliban members, there are people that fought with the Mujahideen who are now military advisors to the rebels. So now we're going to have a nation state that believes in jihad, and they're within missile range of Europe. Was that smart on our part?
John, here, Marty Garrity, give us a 30-second answer, a 10-second answer.
There's no way we should be 100% behind freedom fighters around the world, because that means sending in troops. If we can give them some aid, if we can give them some encouragement and whatever. But if you want to send in troops to almost anywhere, I say no, and that's 100%.
And also one thing is, when you say when the basis of your country is freedom, we love freedom, that the world thirsts for freedom, and we want to export democracy all around the world, we can't second guess the voters when they vote against our wishes. If you want freedom and you want people to chart their own futures, sometimes you may not like where Hamas. They're taking their country. Good example. Back shortly. If you're watching us on TV, see you next week. We'll see you on radio. We'll be back in 10 minutes. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by conservative commentator Marty Garrity, liberal columnist Celine Mouakil from In These Times, and Democratic political strategist Kitty Kurth, president and public of her own firm, Kurth Lampe Public Relations. And the phone number is 1-800-723-8029, 1-800-723-8029. And in the last hour, we were talking about U.S. Foreign policy, primarily focusing on what we've been up to in Libya. And we heard from our two Democratic liberal guests that each of them is somewhat disappointed at President Obama because they believed they wanted him to win the Democratic nomination. They spoke in support of that. Certainly an anti-war position helped perhaps get him that Democratic nomination. Mm-hmm. And they're now saying that they and some of their colleagues are feeling disappointed at the way the president is conducting himself in the foreign policy field. I asked the question rhetorically in hour number one, and now I'll ask it for a little discussion and engage those out in radio land to respond as well. But my question to you, Kitty, since you are the political operative at the table, is there any likely challenge to Barack Obama? That's question number one. And question number two, if there is not, what can you tell us about the intensity of support from the political anti-war left in 2012, and how much reduction do you think there will be from what took place when he was first elected?
The answer is no.
No challenge.
You almost got a one-word answer out of me. That was close. No challenge. I think the intensity is not there now, but by the time of the election, it will be. And it will not be, I believe, in 2012, it won't be as much pro-Obama as it will be anti-whomever the Republican challenge.
Salim, your response to the same two questions.
I agree. I agree with Kitty. I think that there won't be that much enthusiasm, as much enthusiasm as there was the last time. I think that it will be mostly an anti-Republican mobilization going on. People just can't believe what the Republican Party is coming up with.
And some of it might be, you know, In 2008, some local people were beneficiaries of Obama's support. I think in 2012, it's going to be the opposite, that Obama will be the beneficiary of some of the local Democratic activity. For example, up in Wisconsin, with the challenge, the recall elections going on or that will be going on, mm-hmm. and the intensity of opposition that's building
against Walker and Ryan. If he hitches his wagon
to
that intensity, if he hitches his wagon to that pro-union sentiment or that pro-collective bargaining sentiment that's out here, it will help some of the intensity. Build it up.
If he has any sense, he will.
Certainly.
But he needs to. But even the union people are saying he needs to be stronger.
Well, Marty Garrity, you know, because you've run for office and you've both won and lost, you know frequently the difference between winning and losing is the intensity of your base. Mm-hmm. And if part of the base is a little less intense next time than it was last time, that could be an ingredient that could cause you to lose.
Well, it could, but I think that base that we're talking about, the anti-war left base, is always going to be intense on behalf of anybody running against a Republican. The question for Obama will be, can he get any kind of intensity out of the independents. You know, look, there's going to be an intense base of Democrats for Obama. There's going to be an intense base of Republicans for whoever is selected. But the issue will be, can he keep the middle ground? And I really hope, as a conservative, not necessarily Republican, that he does hitch his wagon to the public employee unions, because it'll crush him.
You think so?
Because in the election that they just had, where the issue was clearly one of intensity on the left and interest in the issue, but not intensity on the right, the judge election, okay. Right.
Well, this leads me to my discussion. You can't win any election unless you know who the opposition is. Mm. Last week on this program, we floated not necessarily the trial balloon, but we asked the audience their reaction to this, the growing boomlet for Donald Trump. I want to begin with my card-carrying conservative Republican, because we had one last week who called in, and this was a woman who said that she went all the way back to the Goldwater days, and she was going to vote for Donald Trump.
I heard her.
What's your view on Donald Trump?
I think the notion of Donald Trump as a candidate for president is embarrassing and very destructive. I don't think he could win. What he could do if he runs as an independent, because he won't win the Republican nomination, he could prove to be another
Ross Perot
spoiler to help Obama.
Why
win.
Do you say so emphatically that he would not get the Republican nomination?
Well,
I disagree with you.
Because he's not a Republican. He is. A guy who has never voted in a Republican primary in the last 20 years. He is a supporter of the Kelo decision, which is the famous eminent domain case, where you can take private property to give it to private individuals. Trump is a huge supporter of that. The Republican base right there has enough people against that, mm-hmm. that he can't win. He can't win the primary. Right now, he's the only guy anybody knows about. Well, he and Huckabee. The two. There's a recent poll out that shows that he and Huckabee are sort of tied mm-hmm. for first. What a coincidence. These are the two guys who have TV programs going right now.
And people like him as a TV character.
But I'm not even sure they like him, but they know him.
They know him.
And if you say Tim Pawlenty, people say, Tim who? Or I mean, I'm not shilling for Pawlenty or Huntsman or any of that. Even Haley Barbour, people say, huh? I know Donald Trump. And you, if you give people a list of five names and they know two of them and they don't know three of them, they'll pick those first two. And that's basically where Trump is. But Trump is pro-life. You know what? I've been in the pro-life movement for a long time. I've never heard of a contribution to the pro-life movement by Donald Trump. He says he's fervently pro-life.
No,
I don't believe
it. I thought
he said
he was pro-choice.
He did about
a year ago. He did a year ago.
Years ago. Now he's fervently
pro-life. And he's also a big churchgoer, but he doesn't go to church.
I know that's true too, though. So
I did. I heard the complete opposite today when I was listening to him. But all right. Now, again, political commodity now. We also know that if we turn back the clock 4 years ago, the chattering class, including yours truly, would have been licking their chops because, boy, we couldn't wait for a Rudy Giuliani, Hillary Clinton race for the White House.
Right.
And so we're now seeing a rerun of that with the other superstar from media superstar from New York, Donald Trump.
Let's start with reality. Donald Trump has a lot of money, but he likes to make money. In a couple of weeks, they're going to decide to renew his show or not renew his show. If they renew his show, he can't run for president. So in 2 weeks,
he hasn't
this
taken
boomlet,
himself out of the contention.
No. And so in 2 weeks, there's a pretty good likelihood that this boomlet is all going to be over and we will have spent all this precious airtime talking about Donald Trump instead of important issues.
All right. We'll see.
You're not so sure, huh?
We'll see.
We will see. And I will still say I bet he jumps into the race. Back shortly from Chicago, 1-800-723-8289. He can taste it. He can taste the White House already.
I hope you're right. I hope.
From Johnson County, Texas, to Columbiana County in Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks for being with us. By the way, in the recent poll, one of the recent polls, It had Huckabee and Trump at 16%, Mitt Romney at 13%, Sarah Palin at 10%, followed by Ron Paul and Newt Gingrich at 6%. One of the things that interested me was that when they broke down the overall voters, these were Republican primary voters or potential Republican primary voters, among those that would describe themselves as moderate to liberal, of which there aren't too many in the Republican Party, 13% stuck with Huckabee, 21% went for Donald Trump, 14% went for Mitt Romney, 11% of moderate to liberals went for Sarah Palin. But then look at conservative Republicans, which is certainly a larger base of the party. 18% went for Huckabee. 13% went for Trump or Mitt Romney at the same percentage. And Sarah Palin was just 3 points behind at 10%. So I'm looking at this, and what surprises me about this figure is the strength of Donald Trump with some conservatives. Basically, you know, 5 points behind Huckabee, tied with Romney,
and
ahead of Palin.
Again, Bruce, I can only think that it has to do with celebrity. No one knows what Trump's position is, you know, in terms of liberal conservative on the gay agenda, on pro-choice, pro-life.
But don't we know, based on what happened 4 years ago, don't we know that celebrity, the ability to raise money, that can win you a primary?
No, I don't.
And by the way, 4 years ago, no one knew who Barack Obama was. That's not the problem with Donald Trump.
No, they did. Barack Obama had given that stirring speech at the Democratic National Convention.
He wasn't as well known as Donald Trump is right now.
That speech was considered better than the nominee's speech.
Let's get your reaction from Donald Trump.
I don't think
you're from Harlem.
Yeah, and Donald,
doesn't he own Harlem now?
No, well, damn near. I mean, along with the rest of Manhattan. Donald Trump is not regarded well in many areas of the black community.
Why?
Well, because for one thing, the Central Park joggers case.
Because of the way he treated Amorosa?
You know, he has surprising popularity because of that show, which surprised me.
Oh yeah.
I mean, there are more black people who do think of him fondly because of that show. But in general, he's not regarded well politically. He's made some very strange and outrageous statements. When the Central Park joggers, for example, were proven to be innocent, rather than admit and fess up to making a mistake when he published that full page ad talking about hang them up, string them up, essentially, he refused to make any kind of concession or conciliatory gestures. And so a lot of people, they don't think too well of him.
I find it striking that a guy who is known as a great businessman, who's declared bankruptcy, is it four times?
I think it's only three, but who's
the Yeah.
Who's
well, is he married four times or married three times? Is he bankrupt three times or four times?
I can see the TV commercials now.
I can't wait.
A woman confused by this dilemma. Trying to figure out, discussion.
And is he pro-choice or pro-life? Mm. Where is he?
Well, do you agree that Karl Rove is a loser? Because he called Karl Rove a loser this week. Mm. He says, he is doing the Republican Party a great disservice by trying to stop the discussion about the president not being able to present his birth certificate to the American people or to ensure the American people as to his place of birth. This is a good issue for Republicans, and I can tell you that the president is spending millions of dollars fighting the issue, and he knows he doesn't like it at all. Karl Rove should go into retirement where he belongs. The old machinery is broken, and new and much smarter blood is needed.
Mm.
I would say that Trump's appeal to the birthers who are not on the high end of the intelligence scale in the Republican Party is it's utterly irrelevant. This man is the president of the United States, and we're not going to take him out. He's not going to stop being the president of the United States. In fact, frankly, if we did, Joe Biden would become the president. That would probably be worse. But it is similar. It is very similar to the relatively low end of people whom Democratic fighters or leaders went after when for 4 years, in fact, even more than 4 years, they said Bush stole the election. Bush lost in Florida, even though every single count that was made under any circumstances, Bush won Florida. But the
Marty, same level of intelligence appeals for that. You are absolutely right, but in each case, you're talking about a core of about 30% of the Republican primary voters who you've just dismissed, and you've dismissed – and by the way, I agree the same thing with the Democrats. I mean, you're talking about people who believe that. They have, you know, there are people within the party that demagogue to sort of reinforce that. Trump is doing that. But by doing that, he propels himself to where he is. He basically becomes the darling of the Tea Party movement. And my point is, if you can start a Republican primary battle and you've got 27 to 30% of the vote, you can be the nominee of that party.
Let me just say one thing about conspiracies. Here's a conspiracy for you. It would be very easy for Obama to simply present his birth certificate, if it exists. And frankly, I don't care if it exists or not. I think it probably does. But why isn't he? Because it keeps this battle going, and it makes guys like Donald Trump more likely to succeed, and it makes Republicans more likely to be embarrassed. I submit that maybe one reason Obama isn't presenting his birth certificate is that he loves the mess that it's making for Republicans.
If I was of conspiratorial frame of mind,
you're not, of course.
I would think that Donald Trump is a plant. He's in there to help sink the Republicans.
At least, Salim, at least twice a day, my husband, also a political consultant, Kevin Lampe, says to me, "Now, are you sure Donald Trump isn't really in there because he likes Obama and he's just trying to pull the crazies off and dilute the Republican Party?"
Maybe a chance of that.
I'd love to know if there are any conservative candidates out there, significant conservative candidates over the last 10 years, Santorum, Toomey, Walker in Wisconsin or Johnson in Wisconsin. Did any of them ever get a check from Donald Trump? I'll bet they didn't. Mm.
You know, that's actually something I've been meaning to check and see where Trump gave money politically, because I've
Rahm
never
Emanuel
known him.
Rahm Emanuel got $50,000.
Yeah, he did.
Emanuel got plenty of money from him. Now, he was building out.
Well, again,
so did
Salim's conspiracy theory may be
correct. So did John McCain. So did John McCain. So did Rudy Giuliani.
He couldn't have gotten $50,000. You can't give that much in a presidential.
No, I don't mean that much.
But he got money.
But again, he got money. I mean, when McCain was on today, he was asked about Trump, because Trump did endorse him. And the question that I would ask at this particular point, if there are people out there that despise the president, anybody, what I said last week, and again, obviously you and I disagree on this, Marty, I said I think Donald Trump could be the next president of the United States because I think Donald Trump could still be the Republican nominee. If you can get to be the Republican nominee, you can be president.
I think in 2012 you will be president.
Is Donald Trump registered to vote?
I don't know.
And if so, where?
He says that he's voted in every general election.
General election.
Has anybody checked his registration? Is he really even registered to vote?
The point is he is not. The New York Post said that he has not voted in any primary. I think it's about 15 years before a primary. Mm. But again, I'm just talking about in a world where the people who are the casual observers of politics, the people in this room, we don't deal with, okay? We deal with political junkies. I'm talking about the vast majority out there.
The
masses. Mm-hmm. They're looking for a leader. There's something about this guy. They look for charismatic leaders, and they don't care. In many cases, not all, they don't care how many times he's filed bankruptcy, how many times he's been divorced.
Married.
They don't care about his hair either.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
Here's the other one. Where is he with labor? I will bet you that Donald Trump has created more jobs than anyone who's ever run for president as a Republican nominee in the last 50 years.
But what good is that going to do him? Labor's going to be for Obama.
I think you're right.
But
will the people? Will the, you know,
the little guys?
Will the little guys? This is, you know, the guys who are just voting. It's a very good question. The guy who I think is getting hurt the most by all of this, and you guys are probably going to look at me crazy, but I think Haley Barbour is the most hurt by Donald Trump's. And here's why. Haley Barbour is a guy who is very charismatic, is a really comes off as a really nice guy, a really decent guy, can talk to regular folks, can really connect with voters, can really connect with people, and he's never going to get any oxygen if Trump is in the race.
That's true. And here is a reality, because you're a media person. We are all observers of media. There are certain lines that you can cross and you cannot cross in the world of politics, in my view. One of Obama's, at the core of Obama's ability to do what he did, and his ability to wrest that nomination from Hillary Clinton, is one of the great political triumphs of all time in American politics. He did it on image. He did it on image, packaging, and lots of money. I'm not saying that those same ingredients could not be there for Donald Trump, because he has some of those. Only he has some baggage. He has some baggage. I don't question that. But what I'm saying is, when you look at the rest of the field, you look at the rest of that field.
Well, what is his program?
I
Bruce?
Disagree.
His whole program is a bertha. Is a birth of policy.
The policy is go in and get the oil from Libya. You think there are people in the Republican? I'm talking about Republican primary voters now. First of all, you got to win the primary. I mean, I can see this guy out there throwing red meat, and I look at the field and I'm saying, who else in this field is going to excite people? If there's anybody that's exciting you, 1-800-723-8289. From Wichita, Kansas to Waxahachie, Texas, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. Happy Easter. Hope you enjoyed your Easter holiday today, if indeed you were celebrating one of the holiest days of the year for those who are Christians. Marty Garrity also joins us. He is a card-carrying Roman Catholic, and he is also a conservative Republican who
You've
joins
seen
us
card,
this evening.
Catholic card? We'll see a Catholic card.
The Catholic card. Let's see that. It's a mass card. Also joining us this evening is Salih Muwakkil. He is a senior editor of In These Times, one of the country's leading progressive periodicals. Once upon a time, a member of the Black Panther Party, and also born in the village of Harlem.
Indeed.
And a progressive voice on this program for over 20 years now. Also, Kitty Kurth, who goes back to the early, early days of this broadcast. And she has now matured well, and she is now she has her own public relations firm along with her husband, Mr. Lampy, and it's Kurth Lampy Public
Relations. I beg to differ. I've gotten older, but I have not matured at all.
You don't look that. You don't really look different.
No, thank God. And I don't.
You look very
I haven't
old
matured.
25 years ago when
there
I knew
you.
You.
There you go. No, and I haven't acted any smarter or older either.
Anyway, we're talking about Republican presidential politics. We want to know, the question is whether or not, and by the way, let me just say what I said off the record or off the air. To me, the one who is hurt most by Donald Trump is Mitt Romney. Because Mitt Romney loses this precious thing called oxygen and coverage, and it also the fact that he is where he is right now, to me demonstrates that he has not closed the sale significantly enough. He should be well ahead of everyone else. And he's not played the last 2 years well.
You are absolutely right, Bruce. On paper, Mitt Romney should be sailing, you know, he should be almost taking his victory lap now. On paper, Romney is a great Republican candidate, but something just isn't connecting for him. I can't identify it.
I think it's the Tea Party's influence. I think they're keeping the enthusiasm for Romney at bay, because they have other interests and other passions.
He also has the albatross of the Romney health care plan around his neck.
That's right.
And that, unfortunately, that's a tough albatross. Let's go to Grantham, New Hampshire, talking about where we should be listening. Let's always head to New Hampshire. Steve is listening to us on WNTK. Bob Vinicor is great facility in the Granite State. Go ahead. Nice to hear from New Hampshire tonight.
Yeah, hey Bruce. As always, a great program. I'm happy to be back up in New Hampshire to listen to it.
Good.
I have listen,
by the way,
I'm
we just a quick question, by the way. Just a little, this is a Beyond the Beltway historical moment. We met Bob Vinokur in 1992. Bob Vinokur put us on the air in 1992 in New Hampshire. We go back there every 4 years. We'll be back there again next year or maybe even later this year. But go ahead with your call.
Well, that'll be great. I'm Democratic-leaning, and I would love, in a way, to see Donald Trump become the Republican nominee because, I just hard to believe that so many of the Republicans right now, and it's early in the season and times change very quickly, but, it doesn't seem to me that he's a credible candidate. That doesn't mean he can't become a candidate and win the Republican nomination, but is he really a serious candidate in terms of being a president of the United States? What I don't understand is you have a guy like Mitch Daniels who can't get any traction because he spoke about maybe we shouldn't be talking about social issues, maybe we should be looking at the tax system. And now, Grover Norquist on taxes and the social issues, and he probably a good chance, I guess, he won't even run to be a candidate who's got a great record as a governor and is certainly more moderate
saying that
than
as
a lot
a Democrat.
Of the other Republicans running.
No, I'm saying you're saying that as a Democrat, that Mitch Daniels has a great record.
Yeah, I mean, if I was a Republican, I'd be comfortable saying Mitch Daniels could be a president.
Yes.
Yeah, and you're right.
My concern about Donald Trump getting the nomination is what if he actually won?
Part of Mitch Daniels' problems is that he's short and bald. Yeah. You know, he looks like the guy that 10 women out there didn't go to the prom with or turned down when he wanted to go to the prom. Alas, you have to be reasonably attractive to run for president, and he's simply not.
Daniel's Palin ticket.
Do you have the thanks very much for your question, caller, and comment. One of the things I would ask about Donald Trump is whether or not he is disciplined enough to run.
Yeah.
Granted, I agree with what Karl Rove says. I'm sure Donald Trump or anyone of that wealth is fairly thin-skinned. But I'm wondering whether or not, with his success, whether he is a smart guy. Because, you know, if his arrogance, which I think is real, if his arrogance trumps his smartness.
Trumps, all right.
Then he will not be elected president. But sometimes smart people realize, and this is what Ronald Reagan did. You know, a lot of people thought that Ronald Reagan wasn't smart either.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan was smart enough to bring really smart people into a room, listen to them, and what was the rap on Ronald Reagan? He said everything he believed on 3x5 cards. And what I'm saying is, if that worked in 1980 for a celebrity, granted, he happened to be a two-term governor of California, but first and foremost,
he had a conservative movement behind him.
He had a conservative movement behind him. He also had a Republican hierarchy that was against him.
Right,
remember?
Right.
They were pouring all their money into John Connally. They wanted to stop Ronald Reagan because he was too far out there.
And George H.W. Bush, too.
He was part of that. He was part of the stop, Reagan movement.
Right.
So what I'm just saying is I'm talking now about just the capacity of the man. No one doubts that Barack Obama had the capacity. But sometimes when you are smart, you know you're smart, and you don't listen to anybody.
You're on to something, but not quite in the right way. The reality of politics. The reality of politics is long campaign days, 18-hour days at the minimum, going from one event to another event to another event, having to talk to a lot of people and listen to a lot of people. And I'm not sure that Trump has the capacity to listen. I'm not sure that he has the discipline to do what's required in a political campaign. And when your name is Donald Trump, how are you going to get somebody to write a check to you?
Good question. Let's go to Eddie in Chicago.
Yeah, happy Easter. Yeah, I think Mr. Daniels is underestimated. I think he should run because his state has a surplus as opposed to this state that has a deficit. I think this is somebody who could lower taxes and maybe create more nuclear plants for us to have lower gas prices too in the future.
I agree with you. I would love to see Mitch Daniels. He's not. I don't have a candidate yet, but I absolutely feel more than comfortable with the notion of not only Mitch Daniels, but a number of different people out there in the list.
Bloomington, Illinois. Mitt is calling. This isn't Mitt Romney, is it?
No, this is Nick with an N.
Nick with an N. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to question. I guess it was the one of the conservative panelists. The analogies with Trump and Obama, I see those as being flawed for two reasons. One, Obama was in the same business, if you would like to call it, as politics, for over a decade before he threw his hat into the ring. And two, there's evidence of Obama opposing an issue that united the Democratic base, the Iraq War. Trump has not had experience running for public office, and I don't see there being one issue, per se, uniting the Republican Party that's nearly as big as the Iraq War.
Opposition to Obama.
Yeah, I think that.
Yeah.
And I also wonder, I wonder if the fact that he is not a politician, if that isn't his greatest appeal.
I think it is his greatest appeal. People think they want somebody who's not a politician.
And until, who's tough.
And who's tough.
And who's made a lot of money.
Until they see, who's made and lost a lot of money. But until they see him out on the campaign trail for a couple of years. And you also got to personality, you know, being out in front of people for hours, hours, hours at a time, and you're tired and you're, you know, there's going to become a point where Trump's going to just take somebody's head off.
So thin skin. He's already exploded a few times.
But it's, again, getting back to the impression that many people have, again, not necessarily the most politically astute, but the masses, the impression that they have of Donald Trump, as you say, he's rich, he has beautiful women, he's had beautiful women, he's married, you know, they certainly would all know that by the time the election day comes around. But I think in their mind, the perception is, okay, how would this guy act as president? And they would think about what he does when he brings all of the apprentices in every week and puts them around the table. And they would say, this is how he will conduct either discussions with the OPEC nations, or this is how he will discuss, things with his cabinet. And he's going to beat them up. And he's going to demonstrate leadership.
Yeah, and there's certain.
I want this guy.
There's a certain part of the electorate that want that. You're absolutely right.
He's not going to be sitting around the table and saying, "Okay, well, let's see. What do the French want to do? And what do the British want to do? And what do the Italians want to do?" He's going to. They'd be fired in a heartbeat. We're talking about Republican primary voters at the moment. Mm. I'm not so sure they don't like that.
I think there's a percentage of them that do, and right now it looks like it's about 18%.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Probably closer to the primaries.
1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Kitty, you did a little Google search on Donald Trump's position and his pro-life and pro-choice?
There were articles from February and from like 3 days ago talking about him saying that he was pro-life and pro-choice. So
he's got a lot of more switches between now and election day.
Got everybody on his side, though, doesn't
That's
he?
That's right.
Pro-choice, always pro-choice. They won't be fooled by this.
Let's head to calls. Let's go to Ted listening to us in Hanoverton, Ohio, listening to us on WKBN. Ted, where's Hanoverton?
In Columbiana County, believe it or
Columbiana
not.
Columbiana County.
You mentioned that earlier on the show.
Very good. Well, nice to, I know we got lots of listeners in Columbiana County. We've done the show a number of times from out there, and we'll be heading back to Youngstown to do a show soon, because if you don't win Ohio, you're not going to be the president of the United States. So what
Absolutely
can we do for you
not.
Tonight? Go
okay,
ahead.
My comment is I've heard Trump talk about some economic issues. He's in for imposing a tariff on goods coming in from China, which for at least a blue-collar, we'll call myself that, a blue-collar Republican who sees my job, jobs locally going to outsourcing, that is a really great thing for us. Now, that may not do real great with some of the pure economic conservatives that think, oh, no, free markets, but I don't think free markets, if free markets were truly enforced, I think we'd still have slavery because it would be economically better to have slaves than it would be to pay workers a decent wage.
Marty, is that an issue that, again,
well, yeah,
again
I don't think
you
that
think he's, he has no
tariffs on Chinese products is not a winner or a loser in a Republican primary in 2012. That's not where this issue is going to be resolved. And I don't think – I think that Trump will not succeed, but not because of tariffs on Chinese products will not be an issue.
With a position like that in a blue-collar area like northeastern Ohio – and Western Pennsylvania, does that create the opportunity that Democrats, used to be called Reagan Democrats, blue collar Democrats, who are union members, true and blue, that they might switch over in a Republican primary and vote for Donald Trump if he talked this way?
It's possible. And, you know, remember, there's in a lot of the Democratic primaries, there's not going to be that much going on. So people might even switch over for the Republican Party and then, you know, see what happens for the general.
Mm. Yeah. It,
a lot of mischief.
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunity for mischief. And I think Trump is exploiting that.
Sylvia in Winnebago, Illinois. Go ahead. Listening to us on our flagship WLS, the radio home of Tom Roser.
Well, is it possible that the Tea Party will kick Donald Trump to the curb and under the bus when they find out that he is pro-illegal alien and for amnesty?
Good question.
Possible.
Then what?
Two weeks ago he was for that. Who knows what he's for now?
Yeah, he's pro-immigrant and anti-immigrant, too.
Yeah. So well, what are they going to do then?
That's an issue, and by the way, it was an issue also for Rudy Giuliani. I mean,
that's right.
I would assume that many of the social issues that were associated with Rudy Giuliani would be very similar to those that are associated with Donald Trump.
And Obama promised amnesty within 2 years for the illegals.
I think he promised maybe a path to legalization or something.
That's amnesty.
I doubt that he ever used the word amnesty. That
not
would
right.
be.
Well, of course, he didn't use that word.
Yeah. Well, they're very upset with the president as well.
I know.
But again, in a Republican primary, ma'am, if you had obviously we're going to have a multiple candidate field. Those that feel as you do, there'll be a variety of candidates where they can go, who believe in your position.
Well, somebody's got to take a stand someplace.
Well,
got to draw a line.
Here's
somewhere.
My point: you draw the line, and the people who believe that you, as you believe, they're going to spread their vote five different ways.
But the thing is, in the Republican primaries this year, we're not going to have a winner-take-all deal. So, with this list of people that could be running, you could win 11% of the vote and be the big winner, the number one in Iowa, and you'd in a winner take all primary, you'd get all those votes. Now you're going to end up with a lot of people garnering votes in second, third, fourth, fifth place, and you might end up with a brokered convention then. And I don't think Trump wins a brokered convention.
This evening we have a unique situation. We have in the studio with us a good friend of Kitty Kurth's. Her name is Sally L. Baz. She is from Cairo, Egypt. Nice to have you with us. You are here sort of observing the American political system and American broadcasting and how we take the pulse of America. But I want to ask you a couple of very quick questions. We've only got a couple of minutes left. What can you tell us about what is happening right now in your home country of Egypt? And we should mention you work for the foundation that is run by the nephew of the late Anwar Sadat. A party which represents a lot of young people. Tell us what's happening right now in Egypt.
I think we are now waiting for parliamentary elections as well. So we will. The parliamentary elections will start in October, in September, and then we will have the presidential elections, and then we will have new constitution. So people now, they prepare themselves to run for office, and because the only ready people who are Muslim brothers, and they want to prepare more people to to have many representatives of all political parties as well to participate in these elections.
And are you learning a lot from Kitty Kurth on your trip around Chicago?
Yeah, a lot. I just came into from the revolution, Tahrir Square, to into the fire of political elections here.
Yeah, she came from the revolution in Cairo to the changing revolution in Chicago. As Richard Daley walks out the door and Rahm Emanuel is ready to kick the door in. And we'll be talking about that in the next few weeks as Rahm Emanuel is the mayor in waiting in Chicago. And if you've not been following it around the country, he's shaking things up already with his rhetoric and his actions. And it should be a next fun 4 years as Rahm Emanuel gets settled in the fifth floor at City Hall in Chicago. Our thanks this evening to Marty Garrity, our card-carrying conservative Republican. Kitty Kurth, thanks very much, our Democratic political strategist. And our liberal friend of many, many years, Salim Muakil from WVON Radio and In These Times. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.